right now on the Daily Debrief. Closing arguments in the case of a murdered law professor. The jury has the case against two defendants who say they didn't do it.
A gangster killed Dan Markell.
Plus,
she was dead cold.
The murder of a Florida doctor hammered to death at home. One defendant faces trial starting today. Also, a Chicago City report says police lied about the shooting of an African-American teen. And a new charge against actor Cuba Gooding Jr. as rapper Tekashi 6ix9ine scores big behind bars. The Daily Debrief brings you the day in court. It's Thursday, October 10th.
Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. The jury has the case of the alleged murder of a Florida law professor. Victim Dan Markell was in a tense custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. Prosecutors have argued in court that the fight was a potential motive for murder. Neither the ex-wife nor her relatives have been charged, and the ex-wife seen here testified with immunity that she knew nothing about any alleged plan to kill her ex-husband. The defendants are Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine Magbanua. Magbanua blames Garcia. Garcia says he didn't do it. A third defendant, Luis Rivera, cooperated with authorities and took the stand. He says on the day of the murder, he and Sigfredo Garcia followed Dan Markell, the victim. Garcia's defense attacked Rivera for possible gang associations and flat out argued gang involvement in the killing. With me today are forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan, along with attorneys Anna Carlson and Brian Buckmeyer. Everybody's going to listen as we go into closing arguments now, where it was easy to forget who was on trial. The state placed blame squarely at the family of Dan Markell's ex-wife, but as we said off the top, none of them have been charged.
What was the motive for this murder? Wendy Adelson characterized her divorce as unpleasant, but the evidence shows that that is a severe understatement. When they separated in 2012, Wendy Adelson left with the children while Dr. Markell was away on a business trip. Fast forward to June of 2013, there's an order denying Wendy's motion for relocation with prejudice. That means it cannot be raised again. She cannot move to South Florida with those children by court order. This is the summer of 2013, the same time frame that Wendy Adelson later tells Jeffrey Lacoste that her brother, Charlie Adelson, was looking into all options to resolve the relocation problem, including having Dan Markell killed. This one is from that DonnaHarvey@gmail.com address that both Harvey Adelson and Donna Adelson use. And it's signed Love Mom and Dad, and it's to Wendy Adelson. Never, never, never give up. It's time for action. It's time to take control of your life and not let Gibbers think he just won anything by having you remain in Tallahassee. Let's show this F blank, blank, blank what will make him absolutely miserable.
Toward the end of the state's closing argument, prosecutors tied together the man and the woman currently on trial.
This murder began with the failed relocation efforts when Charlie Adelson first looked into hiring a hitman. It took root when Catherine Magbanua enlisted Mr. Garcia, who enlisted Mr. Rivera, to do this killing. That planning went into the killing was extensive, spanning a six-week period, including 2,000-mile trips made in rented vehicles, scouting out the scene, stalking Professor Markell. And all the planning, all the meetings, all the calls came to fruition when Garcia fired those two shots into Mr. Markell's vehicle and devastated so many lives in an instant. The Prius led to Rivera, Rivera led to Garcia, and the bad blood led to the Adelsons, and both trails end at Catherine Magbanua.
Brian Buckmeyer, you're up first tonight. What's your assessment of the state's closing argument?
So I think the state knew that they had to give a storyline involving motive and the connection to all the parties. Do I think they maybe front-loaded a little bit with the Adelsons and maybe should have focused more on the defendants who were on trial? Yes, but I think that's something that they felt they need to do, and to some degree they did.
Okay, look, if I'm sitting on the jury, I'm asking why am I not trying the Adelsons because the prosecutors are making such a big deal about them.
100%. And again, front-loading with the Adelsons might have the jurors either lose interest, kind of drone out and fall asleep and ask that very question. But I think if you come back hard with who the defendants are sitting at them, it might help the jury get to the decision that the prosecution wants.
The prosecution really wanted to point to motive here. Let's move along. An attorney for each defendant gave a separate closing argument. Sigfredo Garcia's attorney, rather, said the shooting of Dan Markell was the fault of cooperating defendant Luis Rivera.
A gangster killed Dan Markell. Luis Rivera killed Dan Markell. And you know what? It's common sense. 2 and 2 has to equal 4. He's admitted to being involved in these types of actions. Supposedly, when Luis Rivera finds out that this is an actual murder, he even said, yeah, you know, people think I kill people. Wink, wink. So I'm going to go ahead and do this murder for $35,000, right? Because I'm going to be the shooter. And then, I don't know if it's a coming to Jesus moment or a lie. He says, well, I guess I didn't feel like doing it because there's kids involved. You don't think the victims of his robberies have kids? You think he cares about kids? After refusing, allegedly, to do the murder, he claims that on the way up, July 18th, that my client did it, and in addition to getting the money he was told he was going to get, got a bonus for being an Uber driver. That's a real expensive Uber ride. You got to think, if my client hired him, why would my client even go up there? This is not a two-man job. It's a one-man.
Magbanua's attorney fired back. Her side agrees Sigfredo Garcia and Charlie Adelson had some sort of a conspiracy, but this side argues the agreement was through Magbanua. Wasn't through her, rather, it was about her.
The bump gave him the idea to use Catherine as a buffer. Find out who it is. Call that number. Think about this. He believes, or he's involved in this conspiracy with Catherine, and he's thinking, hey, it could be the FBI, it could be the cops. That he would say, hey, I want you to call that number, knowing that she could say something wrong, she could do something wrong to incriminate him. The reason why he was so confident with having her call is because he knew she didn't know anything. But when Catherine wants to know, what is this about? The answer is, the less you know, the better. There's no information flowing in between there. Investigator Dillmore, in reviewing Sigfredo Garcia's phone, saw that there were communications with T, talking about Luis Rivera. The flow of information from the bump made it around the horn. One would think that if this is a conspiracy, the information is then going to flow back. But it didn't. Agent Sanford said how there was a point where Charles Adelson was sure it was the cops. And then he tells Catherine. If it were set up in the way that they think it was, that information would have flown back and Catherine would have been the one telling him. Who told Charles Adelson?
Anna Carlson, you're here now. What do you make of the defense theories in these closing arguments?
It's hard that these cases are being tried together. I think that they're obviously two competing defenses. And I think if these trials had been separated, you might have had a better chance for each defendant. I think Garcia's defense attorney is doing an excellent job being really hard-hitting about Luis Rivera, who I thought was a terrible witness. I thought he was unbelievable. And he did an excellent job making the most of the really favorable deal that he's received. This witness, Luis Rivera, has received a plea deal which will have him serving just 7 additional years for essentially his participation in a murder.
So the possibility that he may be lying again, you know, she blames him, he blames the other guy. It's a big circular defense as well. The question is, does the state prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt? Let's move on now. We've got a lot more to talk about. Defendant Catherine Magbanua, of course, took the stand, but Sigfredo Garcia did not. Here, Magbanua describes the tension between Garcia and the brother of the victim's wife, his name Charlie Adelson. She testified that she was involved with both of those men at the same time.
Because he didn't like him.
So Mr. Garcia comes and he picks up the kids. Now, after he picks up the kids and leaves, who comes and picks you up?
Charlie.
Okay. And you get in the car with him?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. and you guys are just going to go and take the jet skis out.
Yes, ma'am. Siegfried will cut us off.
Okay. In what?
In the car. On the car.
Now, describe for the jury what you mean, cut you off. Like, did he... Describe for them.
Oh, like, we were driving out of our parking lot, and then he cut us off, like, right in front. Like, he went around us and cut us off and blocked the street.
Did Mr. Adelson have to slam on his brakes to stop?
Yes.
Were your children in the car with Mr. Garcia?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did Mr. Garcia get out of the car?
Yes, ma'am.
What was he doing?
Screaming in the middle of the street.
At who?
At us.
Did you guys roll down the windows?
No.
Do you have any idea what he was yelling?
No.
Was he yelling in Spanish or English?
I don't know.
What did Mr. Adelson do?
Well, he was freaking out. He was trying to figure out how he can make a turn to go the other way around with the jet ski, like, hitched in the back.
Okay. So he didn't get out the car and confront Mr. Garcia?
No.
Justice Scott Morgan, there's a lot of finger-pointing going on here. She's involved with Charlie Adelson. She's involved with her co-defendant. They don't like one another. The prosecution's pointing the finger at people who aren't even charged. The defendants are blaming one another. Do the forensics give us any answers here?
I don't know. You guys broadcast out of New York. I feel like I need a playbill to keep up with everybody in this thing. It goes back and forth. I don't know if the forensics are going to... You know, one of the things I've wanted to see throughout this entire case that they can't produce is a weapon. I ain't got a weapon. The jury wants to see the weapon. Everybody wants to see the weapon to put it in, you know, to put it in their hands. Our colleague Anna just a little while ago mentioned this kind of dubious testimony that was given relative to the angle of the fire that came out of the window. And, you know, you can't hang your hat on that. I think the only forensics that they're going to have here are the numbers relative to the banking, these numbers of just tons of money that were transferring back and forth between these people, and also the digital footprints that are left behind by their phones. That's
We got the phones, we got the money. There's a lot of money changing hands, and we heard the theory that maybe, oh, it's just all drug money. It doesn't have anything to do with murder. Does that really help?
Yeah, I think that it can help the defense, you know, when you're trying to paint this picture. They're trying to create confusion amongst all of this, and they've done a jam up job, I have to admit. I think that they may have planted the seed of reasonable doubt in this case. You know, we'll see how it comes out. They're in that little room debating.
Exactly.
Right now.
The jury's moving along. Joseph, we'll see you at the end of the broadcast here. The city of Chicago's inspector general says 16 police department employees participated in the cover-up of the deadly shooting of Laquan McDonald. Officer Jason Van Dyke was convicted of second-degree murder in the on-duty shooting of the 17-year-old victim. A new report says officers exaggerated the threat that McDonald posed. The report also says a lieutenant disposed of notes made by detectives which detailed interviews with witnesses. It further says at least two officers lied when they claimed they heard Van Dyke tell McDonald to drop a knife that he was holding. The inspector general's report concludes that the police department pushed a, quote, false narrative about what happened. Rapper Tekashi 6ix9ine is scoring big behind bars. According to TMZ, the rapper has secured a record deal worth more than $10 million. Tekashi 6ix9ine pleaded guilty to charges including racketeering. He testified against Bloods gang members in exchange for a possible lighter sentence. His former record label is apparently banking on him getting out earlier than the possible 47 years he faces. He's scheduled to be sentenced on December 18th. Actor Cuba Gooding Jr. is facing an additional charge in a New York sex abuse case. He's already facing two misdemeanors for allegedly groping a woman at a Manhattan bar. The district attorney's office didn't say what the new charge is, but it's expected to be unsealed at his arraignment next week. If convicted, the actor faces up to a year in jail. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a case involving money, sex, a dead doctor, and three defendants, one of whom is her husband. Prosecutors say she was hammered to death, her husband, two other men accused of murder. The trial of one of those defendants begins today. We have the opening statements. Prosecutors say our next case is about the perfect marriage, the perfect friendship, the perfect alibi, and the perfect murder, or at least almost perfect. On June 29, 2015, Dr. Teresa Severs did not show up to work. A friend checked on her and discovered her cold, bludgeoned body. She'd been beaten to death with a hammer. Months later, police charged her husband with plotting to kill her. Investigators say Mark Sievers hired his longtime friend from Missouri, Curtis Wright, and Wright's friend, Jimmy Rogers, to kill the wife. Rogers is now on trial. Wright struck a deal with prosecutors and is expected to testify at this trial against Rogers. Sievers is expected to go to trial after Rogers. Here's how the state says the murder was executed.
Dr. Sievers had time to put her purse down and turned around to see Mr. Wright standing behind her. She looked at him like, why? And Mr. Wright hit her with the hammer. He hit her again, and she started to fight with him. She had her hands up, trying to protect herself from fighting with Mr. Wright. Mr. Wright's going to tell you that at some point, Mr. Rogers came out of nowhere. He's either going to use the word berserk or the word crazy. Mr. Rogers engages with his hammer, and he starts hitting her. And she's trying to fight them both. At some point, she bends over at the waist, has her hand on the counter, I think he's going to say. He remembered having her hand on the counter because she's still fighting, even though she's being overcome by a hammer. Mr. Rogers continued hitting her until she fell down on the floor.
The defense says this was a revengeful murder plotted by Sievers and Wright, but not by their client.
So when I talk about flaws, this idea of a hitman coming down to kill Mr. Sievers' wife is simply not true. There was no plan. There was no agreement as to compensation. Certainly none with Mr. Rogers. There was absolutely no communication between Mark Sievers and Jimmy Ray Rogers. Pay particular attention because that physical evidence is wholly inconsistent with what Mr. Wright says happened. Entirely inconsistent. From the hammer to the injuries to Dr. Sievers. But it made a good story. Got him much lesser sentence.
The victim's sister testified that the family gathered in New York the weekend before the murder to celebrate their mother's birthday. The plan was for Teresa to leave before her husband, so Teresa, the victim, returned to Florida alone.
I was in New Windsor, New York, with my mother, her husband, my siblings, Teresa, Patrick, Frank, and each of us were with our significant others and children celebrating my mother's birthday that had happened previously that year. The Sievers family left New Windsor to take my sister to a New York airport. I don't remember which one. And my sister from that airport would be flying back to Fort Myers and returning to her home in Bonita Springs. Mark Sievers and his daughters were to be returning to stay with my mother for several days in Connecticut at her home.
After receiving word his wife had not returned to work, husband Mark Sievers asked one of his wife's fellow doctors to go to their home to check things out.
He said that she didn't show up at work, that he had tried calling her on her cell phone, but there was no answer. He believed that he said the phone was dead and that he had traced it to the house, which I found odd that you could trace a dead phone to the house. He wanted me to go directly into the house, which I thought was odd. I did not feel that was appropriate. I said, I'm going to go to the front door. He said, just go inside the garage door. As I went through the laundry room, it was plain and obvious on the kitchen floor, there was a hammer that was laying there. As I was first going in, I saw blood on the floor to the left. And as I stepped in further, then I saw my friend Teresa on the floor by the refrigerator. I approached her more closely and I saw how her head had been bashed in. So I checked for signs of life, and she had none. She was dead cold.
Our guests are back one last time tonight. Joseph Scott Morgan, you're the forensics expert here, and we heard the defense say that the physical evidence is not going to match the state's theory. This has got to be your favorite kind of trial because the forensics are going to be key.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we're going to have a tremendous amount of physical evidence that's offered up in this case. I think that it'll be riveting for our viewers to watch. We're going to be talking about things like bloodstain examination. We're also going to be talking about forensic pathology and the amount of force that it takes to literally crush this woman's skull. She was beaten to death by the hammer that we can see here. And interestingly enough, Aaron, this hammer was left at the scene. This is a crime of extreme anger, a crime of passion. You generally do not see cases like this where someone is bludgeoned to death unless they truly have an emotional connection to the individual.
Exactly. And look, we have the husband being one of the defendants here. Let's jump in with the attorneys, though. We basically have a state's theory here that's based on the story told by a cooperating defendant, and you're shaking your heads that that turns into a problem. Anna, what do you make of it?
I mean, I think there's much more of a connection between the cooperating witness and the victim here, and I think the story that they're floating that he's going to tell really doesn't make sense. And it's not going to match up with the forensic evidence that we've also heard about today. So we had testimony today from the crime scene investigators saying that they recovered no DNA and no fingerprints from either one of these defendants, from Jimmy Rogers currently on trial or from the cooperating witness. And I think I'm surprised to hear that this is a close-in hand-to-hand combat situation with a hammer, and that there's absolutely no trace evidence linking to Rogers, who's on trial.
Yeah, Brian Buckmeyer, when we lay out the three pictures of the accused individuals here, you've got the husband, the husband's friend, and then the friend's friend. This defendant is the one that's the furthest removed from the victim here. That seems like a relatively strong possible argument.
Yeah, you definitely go, you piggyback off of what Joseph Scott Morgan said. This seems to be a crime of passion. Maybe the prosecution will come back and say, hey, two people bludgeoning her head at the same time, that equals the 17. You got 9 and 8. But one of the questions I had, if this is all going down, why was only one hammer recovered? Why not both? Definitely a big question.
Many questions to be answered, hopefully, by prosecutors here. Thanks to the panel. That's all the time we have on The Debrief. The network's coverage of this and other cases will pick up tomorrow at 9 a.m. We'll see you then.